Okay, we'll go ahead and move into approving the minutes of the January 14th, 2016 meeting. Lori or Susan, did you get a copy of those to review?
Yes, I did. I'm not sure if you can hear me.
Can't
yes,
now.
I can hear you. Oh, good. Thank you. Yes, I got copies.
Any changes or corrections?
This is Lori. I don't see any, and I would move to approve the minutes as submitted.
All right, we have a second.
Second.
Okay, Susan seconds. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? All right, minutes approved. So we'll go up to our rules update.
Good morning. This is Cindy Fazio, and as you all probably know, we did adopt the rules on March 30th, and so that sets them for an effective date of April 30th. And the rules as adopted had just one change from the 102 version, and that was a change to one of the sections on Gramm-Leach-Bliley. We just corrected a technical error that talked about the potential exemption that was available. So you can see those rules on our website. They haven't been codified yet, and I'm assuming it'll be another month or so before they're codified, so you won't be able to see them right now on the legislature's website, but again, you can see them on our website. And you can always look at that other rulemaking document, the concise explanatory statement, to see the specifics of the document that was adopted versus the CR 102 document. So if you have any questions, let me know. Otherwise, those rules will sit out there on our website, and like I say, you can expect them to be codified probably within a couple months.
Great. And Cindy, was the department still considering any rule changes or any other changes regarding know before you owe and TRID? There was, I know, talk about the definition of consummation a while back. It didn't go anywhere, but I thought you were also possibly working on some changes. I don't recall seeing any in this last rulemaking that were specifically targeted to that.
Right. We went through the rules and didn't feel that there were any specific TRID changes that needed to be made. The way that we handled the TRID changes under our other mortgage statutes was to genericize the use of the terms good faith estimate and settlement statement so that those concepts would include the new loan estimate and the new closing disclosure. Where necessary, we were specific as to those documents. But as you know, those documents don't cover, the new documents don't cover every single transaction. So we had to accommodate the original good faith and the original settlement statement while bringing in those new changes. So if you see anything in the rules that we missed as far as TRID, please be sure to send me an email and point that out, and we'll pick it up next time around. But so otherwise, that's how we handle that.
Okay, maybe an item. I was going to say maybe an item for your newsletter might be a reminder to agents that they still need to do a settlement statement for their file for DFI purposes in addition to what the lender does with the CD form. So there's no confusion.
And so you're talking about the situation, Phil, where because the lender is preparing the closing disclosure, is that what you're referring to, the fact that you need to have a copy of that in your file?
Well, no, I'm speaking more to if there are any escrow agents that are under the misconception that the closing disclosure is the new settlement statement, and that is all that's needed. Maybe it's a question for the department. I was under the understanding the department would still want to see an escrow settlement statement in our files, because it's more of a disbursement worksheet than the closing disclosure is. And if that's the case, maybe a reminder in the newsletter to agents that even though the lender is doing a closing disclosure to summarize the transaction, a settlement statement should still be retained in the agent's file.
And I totally agree.
Phil, I think Rick might want to speak to that, or Joe might want to speak to that.
I would agree. This is Rick, and I would agree that you should probably keep records of how you do your disbursements, but the closing disclosure and a settlement statement do not need to be retained. Only the closing disclosure as far as for the lender's transaction. But I think Joe will agree that we still need to keep documentation of disbursements.
Isn't the best way to do that with a settlement statement?
What's that?
Isn't the best way to do that with a settlement statement?
Yeah, just generally, I see both the closing disclosure as well as the settlement statement in the escrow file. Oftentimes, there are variances because you don't get, like, the lender's instructions till really late, sometimes the day of closing, even though you're supposed to get it ahead of time. So, I generally see both in the file just because there's variances that need to be explained.
So it sounds like we will be looking for a record of the disbursement, but that it couldn't take a variety of form.
This is Susan. I have to say I disagree with that completely, because I think we have to have a settlement statement in our that we've generated, because if we're relying on a CD that the lender has generated, they may not have last minute changes like utility holdback disbursements, change in recording fees, that sort of thing. I think we have to have a settlement statement that reflects what we have cut from our file, because the lender is not privy to those things after the fact.
And it may not be that the settlement agent would get a corrected CD if there were any last minute changes. So by setting a baseline, so to speak, where all the agents do their own settlement statement, examination would see the final figures as dispersed by the settlement agent versus what the lender is preparing on their disclosure. So it's an idea maybe for the newsletter that we don't have to come to a conclusion today, but...
Yeah, it sounds like a good issue that we'll look at more closely here, and we may reach out to a few of the committee members to get more input.
Are there any other questions for the department on rules update from the audience? Thank you, Cindy. So we'll go to a legislative update.
Okay, well, most of you know that our agency request legislation this year was a bill to renew the mortgage lending fraud prosecution account for another 5 years. It was set to sunset at the end of June. Senate Bill 6282 was signed into law by the governor, so it will now be in effect for another 5 years. And that's the only update that I have.
Okay. I also noted that Patty Maddox, one of the committee members, has joined. Patty, are you able to hear us and speak okay?
Yes.
Okay. Licensing update.
Good morning. This is Dawn. From the last escrow committee meeting, our main offices dropped by 5. We're now at 60 main offices. The branches have dropped by 2. We're at 6. Active escrow officers are at 88. We dropped by 3. Inactive EOs increased by 4. We're at 55 now. And our total escrow officers are now at 143. We have received a couple new applications for companies that we're working on, and we have also approved a couple more branches. And that's all for licensing. Anybody have questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Examination update.
Hi, this is Joe Wong with Innocence Unit. For first quarter 2016, we completed nations. There were with an average, the average cost increased slightly by $14.85 to $1,494. There were six the average exam cost $14.97 to $1,955.72. Lastly, there were two 3-rated exams, and the average cost actually decreased approximately $30 to $120.24. Regarding common violations, there were two. The first, again, this kind of an ongoing issue, failure to properly administer outstanding checks. I've seen a lot of checks that are exceeding the 90-day period, as well as a small amount of checks that are exceeding the 3-year achievement time frame. Second most common violation was failure to maintain trust account records. There are three subcategories. Escrow agents for cyber preparing to maintain certain records or maintain records that listed escrow numbers that could trace it back to individual escrow accounts. And there are also a few agents that were cited for failing to retain the backside of checks. We did a lot of our contract collection companies for first quarter. So the second violation mainly has to do with that subsection of escrow agents' contract collection services. And this is their first go-around being examined. So there's a bit of a learning curve. I also wanted to state that an escrow agent, this isn't a common violation, this is just a FYI. An escrow agent recently reported a closing where the buyer fell victim to a wire fraud scheme. And it's very much an ongoing situation, but what we know at this point is the buyer is trying to close an all-cash purchase and sale transaction, wired out a significant amount of money under fraudulent wire instructions. It appears the buyers were victim to both the email spoofing as well as phishing scheme, where the fraud fake email accounts that were almost identical to that of multiple real estate professionals involved in the transaction and tricked the buyers into wiring out funds. If you don't already have information security policies and procedures in place that address this specific issue as well as information security as a whole, I'd recommend you research the issue and develop a information security program. The National Association of Realtors issued a bulletin in May 2015 specifically regarding customer wire fraud schemes. The FBI and the FTC have guidance in cybercrime. And DFI actually has an information security resource webpage, and this is just to name a few resources. The following resources recommend you maintain good communication with parties to the transaction, so you educate your consumers from the beginning to be mindful of fraudulent real estate schemes, including wire schemes. And they also say you should ensure your customers know to immediately call their escrow closer if they receive any instructions to remit funds. You should implement encrypted email. And you should also consider not sending sensitive information over email. You could use web portals that house certain documents. Do not use free email accounts for work. or don't use a mix of both work as well as personal email accounts to conduct work-related business. You should also use the fuller email function if you receive what you may think is a suspicious email or an email that contains sensitive way you're actually inputting into the email. You're actually writing the email instead of just responding to an email that you received. You actually have to input the recipient. You should include fraud warnings in your email signature and other communications with the customer. And then you should also use dual-factor authentication for receipt of funds. So the customer, again, immediately calls their escrow closer to verify the information in the wiring instructions. And then they also call the email closer right before they're going to email funds, and then you call them back to confirm receipt of funds. With that said, is there any questions regarding examinations or anything that I've addressed?
This is Charlie. I'd just like to add on to some of the points you made, Joe Paul. We issued an alert that hopefully everyone received. I think we sent it out about 3 weeks ago. And Joe Paul, that was a great summary of considerations. One thing that I just wanted to pass along to the committee is I saw the email at issue, and with some other industries, I've seen some of the spoofing emails, and they're very convincing. You'll have a history of communicating with Joe at XYZ escrow company. The email is from Joe at XYZ escrow company.com. They get an email that says, okay, it's time to wire funds. Here's the wire instructions. And, you know, I think the consumer is thinking, well, yeah, this all makes sense. It's in line with the pattern of emails I've been receiving from this person. So it's kind of a very dangerous situation. In the escrow context, one idea that came up is very early on in the transaction, if your trust account is at a specific bank, maybe a state chartered bank, you might tell the parties to the transaction, we will only ask you to wire funds to this particular bank, versus in this situation, the funds were wired to a national bank that none of the parties were using. So additional thoughts there.
How do you propose, every lender asks us for wire instructions, and we have at the top of our wire instructions, these are not to be forwarded under any circumstances, yet we find that processors and loan officers just willy-nilly will hand out our wire instructions to borrowers. We
sure
can't tell the lenders we will
right
give them to them, but how do we control that?
Right. You can't control that. All you can control is the best practices that you've implemented. And unfortunately, sometimes if you forward it to a party, they may provide information or forward information that's in conflict with your internal practices. But in this specific case, I don't believe the buyers were able to recover the funds, so they retained counsel, and the first thing the counsel required is an IT audit of all the parties involved in the transaction, so real estate agent, title company, independent escrow company. So, I mean, I hope no one else becomes a false victim to this, but if unfortunately you do, you're going to have to prove that you have both the information security program in place and you followed all the procedures that are outlined in the written program.
Do you recommend, you know, we usually only send the wire instructions separately and encrypted, but there's all kinds of correspondence with borrowers throughout. Is it recommended at this point that we start encrypting every single thing that we send, or just the sensitive information?
You know, that's a good question. That's like a business decision that you have to make on your point. You know, I have heard that there has been some pushback, not only by the customers, but by other parties to the transaction, because encrypted email, if you don't already have that system, takes additional steps to sign up for it. But unfortunately, that's the environment that we operate in now. And you really, as a business, can't afford to make a mistake and have this happen. This is a mistake that you just can't afford to have happen to business.
But from the story you're telling, it sounds like the emails that are made to look authentic are mm-hmm. taken from a pattern of previous non-sensitive information that's sent, and then all of a sudden there's sensitive information, and then that's what do you call it, spoofed? I don't have the right words, but so you know, if we're just sending out an opening letter, is that being somehow taken and then that information retained for a later problem? I guess I'm not understanding how criminals work here.
I think I think you're exactly right. I think what Joe Paul's kind of struggling with is we don't have the answer. Industry's got to come up with the answer to this kind of new problem. But you're right. In this situation, it looked like a key component to send an email to try and spoof the customer was looking at prior emails. I think they may have even had an example of a previous wire transfer that they could doctor with the company logo on. And so as to whether everything needs to be encrypted, something needs to be done to increase safeguards. We don't have the answers. Those are things that industry should be considering based on their evaluation of risk. You know, the other part of that is maybe just overdoing upfront communication with the parties and making sure that they always call before any funds are wired.
That's a good idea.
How does that money get recovered then?
That's a good question.
I mean, it doesn't sound like it was the escrow agent's fault because it came through a real estate agent's email.
Well, we can't really,
or whatever.
We've been careful not to assess liability to any party in this situation,
okay.
But yeah, there's an issue there.
So, I mean, if let's say we had a client call and say, you know, did you get my wire that I sent $500,000? And we say no, and then they say, well, I sent it to such and such bank, and we say, well, that's not our bank. What's the first thing we should do? Call BFI, call our insurance company,
The first thing you have to do is have the buyers contact all the banks involved to try and recall the wire. To recover the funds, they should contact their local police department and file a police report, and then they should also contact the FBI, FBI's local office. The FBI has a cyber crime unit that they'll work with regarding the matter.
But what do we do? That's what the customer does. What's the first thing we do?
There's nothing that precludes you from filing with those parties as well, just to show due diligence. The company involved also contacted the FTC to file a report. Other than that, this is kind of a new issue. It's a gray area, so that's all I can recommend at this point.
One tricky area that the escrow company may encounter is if the funds are wired from the customer's bank account, the bank may not be real open to sharing information with a non-account holder. And so your hands may be tied a little bit as far as what you can do, but it certainly doesn't hurt to kind of build a record of trying to do everything you can to offer assistance to the customer.
So you should also probably contact an attorney.
Great.
I mean, it's scary. I heard about that incident. And
what area is this in our state? I take it.
We did have so right when in our state, one of our licensees.
It's happening all over. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Every state's experiencing it. Every closer. It's almost a matter of when it'll happen, not if. It's also a good time to talk about ACH filters on trust accounts again, since we're on that subject of security. That's the old school way to grab money out of your trust account by, I call pinging it. Once they get your wire instructions, they can try an ACH debit your account.
Right, but we should have blocks on that with the bank, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, and if you have employees, we've seen these same convincing emails from the CEO or owner saying, HR person, send me all the Social Security numbers and all the W-2s for our employees. And in fact, there was an article here in the Olympian where the Olympia School District had that happen to them, and there, I think, were over 2,000 employees that had their data breached.
I feel like those of us who are really small little companies, I don't know how much you can put into place. I mean, we do encrypted, and we have an outside IT company to monitor, but I mean, it's scary. I agree.
Anything more for examination? Any questions? Go ahead and move on to enforcement.
Well, at least in enforcement, there's a little bit of good news. Of the 16 complaints that we received in the quarter, all of them were unlicensed activities. So there weren't any complaints against any licensees in the quarter. So I guess that's some good news. And the investigations that we have pending are also, I believe, all related to unlicensed activity. The only exception is the consent orders that we entered in the quarter. Two were unlicensed activity, and one was against a licensee, but it was simply related to quarterly reports and timely responding to our directives to provide information. So overall, obviously the complaints against licensees are way down, which I think we're all glad to see, and especially compared to the rest of our industries.
That is good news. Any questions for enforcement? Does anybody have any old business to bring up? Under new business, has the department got any information or comments about an OIC proposed, I wouldn't call it a rulemaking, I'm trying to search for the word, but they apparently put out to their licensees that they might adopt your standards for their escrow departments of title companies?
Well, so I think they've filed their 101. We haven't seen any proposed rules yet. We've met with OIC's examination folks and program managers on occasion here in the last couple of years, and I think they've been kind of exploring what to do in this area. We've offered our assistance to help with that. For years we've recognized that that settlement agents are being treated a little differently as far as the burden of being subject to examination, and so this is promising that it would hopefully level the playing field a little bit, but we don't have much more information on that.
So it's more of your education from DFI to OIC, and OIC will adopt it, and their staff would conduct it or enforce it, administer it. It's not really where you'll be involved.
That's correct. We won't have authority over those companies.
Okay. Any other new business items from any committee members or audience members?
Nope. Has DFI had any complaints about PHH mortgage services?
I can't say offhand because we may have an open investigation and so I wouldn't really get into the number or nature of complaints, but I can tell you with any large originator or servicer, it's not uncommon to have complaints. If you have a specific issue that you'd like to learn more about, you can contact Steve and he can help you either, you know, get a public records request or share what he can.
All right. Well, if no other questions for new business, it sounds like we'll adjourn the meeting.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.